very dramatic distinction between the physical realm and the spiritual realm that you get in a lot of philosophies. You have the spirit indwelling people, for example. Mm-hmm. So the spiritual realm is linked to the physical realm. God created the physical realm. Mm-hmm. And there are spiritual realities that exist.
So if you're Jewish,
well,
you don't get a Jewish ruach, and if you're not Jewish, you get like a Gentile ruach?
Well, no. You'll have to show me a scripture one way or the other to decide that. But I think more to the point of what you're saying is that particular verse where it says there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither male nor female, slave nor free. Mm. What does it mean? What does that verse mean?
As God looks at
it. First of all, what do many Christians say that it means?
That they're equal with the Jews and they have everything.
Well, it means that Jewishness is no longer something that exists, really. Yeah. It means that Jews and Gentiles are the same. Now, unfortunately, they don't take this to mean, or fortunately, maybe, they don't take this to mean that men and women no longer exist. But unfortunately, from the perspective of consistency. So if we're going to be consistent, we would have to say that men and women no longer exist. Well, obviously, that's not what's being said in the verse, right? It's not being said that Jews and Gentiles no longer exist. It's not being said that slaves and free men no longer exist. Because the same author writes specific instructions to Jews. He writes specific instructions to Gentiles. He writes specific instructions to men, specific instructions to women, specific instructions to slave, and specific instructions to free people. So there are actually different things that are required of all those different groups of people because they get different instructions. But there's no distinction in the ability to come to God. God accepts anyone who comes to him. And so all such statements have to be evaluated in their context. I mean, like many other verses that people would use to try to say that Jewishness is no longer valid or something that God no longer maintains, that verse is misinterpreted, and misinterpreted in a way that isn't even consistent with its own content in that single verse, let alone the content in the rest of the scriptures. So, I mean, the scriptures use many literary techniques. They use a lot of different forms of expression. They're sometimes very poetic. But even without regard to that, if you just look at the plain meaning of the text and read it consistently, you can see that some of the standard interpretations don't apply. The person who wants to say that there is no difference between male and female, according to God, would, I guess, technically have a right to say that there's no difference between Jew and Gentile, according to God. But they might have other problems if they say that. If they say that in a universal, unqualified sense, it's true in the sense in which it was stated. Mm-hmm. But you have to say, in what is there no difference? In what is there no difference between male and female with regard to God?
Definitely is in leadership.
But how one reaches God.
Well, no, in what is there no difference?
Salvation by faith.
No, it's
okay.
Jesus dying as the atonement for everyone.
Okay. Are there still things in which there are a distinction between men and women?
Yes.
Are there spiritual things still in which there are a distinction between men and women?
Depends.
I guess it depends how you... Well, I guess it depends how you define spiritual. But spiritual in the sense of, I would say, you know, requirements or duties that God places on men and women, responsibilities that God places on places on men and on women. Are there any differences in these things? Or is it purely a physical distinction?
Well, would you say that Jewish people should keep kosher or and that Gentiles don't need to, or would you say?
I'm not sure how you got to that, but...
Are there different instructions that they keep the law of Moses and that Gentiles don't have to?
Well, that's one possibility. I mean, I'm not going to necessarily take a specific perspective on that right now, but one of the differences is that certain things were commanded to Jews that were not commanded to Gentiles, right? Now, whether Gentiles should keep those things or not is a different question. I mean, one example would be the Shabbat. Mm-hmm. Well, Israel was specifically commanded to keep the Shabbat. Were the Gentiles, the nations, ever commanded to keep the Shabbat? Not that I'm aware of, no. Mm-hmm. So there's a distinction right there. However, in Isaiah 58, I believe it is, Gentiles who keep the Shabbat are promised a reward. So there is a distinction in the commandment and so forth. And in many other instances, I mean, we don't even have to go into particulars because you just look at the whole Torah, which was commanded to Israel, and then look at what they decided in Acts 15 should be laid on Gentiles. It's just a few things from the Torah. Mm-hmm. And the implication may be, many people would argue that the implication is that the Gentiles would learn more of the commandments as they developed in the faith, as they became more familiar with God's ways and would keep more of them. But they were not commanded all those things that Israel was commanded. Mm-hmm. So there are some distinctions. Nonetheless, a main part of Romans 1 and 2 is that all people are without excuse, whether they have the Torah or whether they don't have the Torah, because God has placed within each person an ability to know what is right and what is wrong. So those who have the law, that's the next verse, I believe. How far did we read?
Through 11.
So verse 12 through 4, well, maybe someone wants to read verses 12 through 15.
For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not the hearers of the law who are just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified. For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them.
Okay, thank you. So, I mean, look at even verse 12, and let's rephrase it. Is this a valid statement? God judges some people without the law and some people with the law. Yeah. It's a valid statement according to that. It seems like God is being unequal. But he's not. It's the exact same principle that's at play in each case, Jews and Gentiles, men and women, and so forth. God's righteousness is the same. His requirements are the same. But the specific particulars of how they're manifest in this or that situation appear to be different. And so God's impartiality is that all who sin apart from the law will also perish apart from the law. And all who sin under the law will be judged under the law. So you are judged, you're evaluated according to the position in which you are in. That actually sounds pretty fair. But it looks unfair from the outside, if you just glance at the surface of what's being said. And I think the inevitable conclusion of this, which is related to what I was saying before about the Syrian Greek woman, is that none of these differences and none of this distinction in order, whether with regard to the gospel, the good news, or judgment, or honor, or what have you, is really for the sake of the person in either camp. The principles are the same. The reason that God has made these distinctions are for his own purposes. God has made certain distinctions between Jews and Gentiles for his purposes, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the chapter. The verses 13 and 14 are driving home the point that Gentiles can be righteous even without knowing the Torah. Pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And Jews can be unrighteous while knowing the Torah. That's the other thing that's being said. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Romans 2 ends the way it does, which is what we were talking about previously. So again, God's idea of what is fair and what isn't fair is different from what we might think it is. And God's idea of fair is not just smoothing everybody out into being exactly the same.
That goes to the whole big question of, I'm sorry, I'm killing the time here, but that those who don't know Yeshua,
mm-hmm.
can you be saved without knowing him?
No. Okay, I thought you were going to say something different, which is more related to the topic of the chapter, which is those who don't know Yeshua, where are they with regard to these issues of identity? And that's an important question for sort of solidifying this discussion, because what it means is that a Jew is a Jew regardless of belief in Yeshua or not. A Gentile is a Gentile regardless of belief in Yeshua or not. See, that's where people often don't have the correct interpretation, but that's necessary. A male person is male regardless of belief in Yeshua or not. A female person is female regardless of belief in Yeshua or not.
Yeah.
So there are different categories of people. Unbelievers and believers is one category in the scriptures. But there are several others too. And they don't conflict. The Jewish and Gentile identity persists. And the male and female identity persists. And apparently even your slave status or your freedom persists as well. In the letter to Philemon, receive back your slave, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that a good answer to your question? Let's move on a little bit in the chapter. The question arises then, what is the purpose for which God has made this distinction between Jews and Gentiles? What is the distinction between Israel and the nations, and what purpose does it serve? Is it ethnocentric? Is this understanding motivated by the goal of making Jews superior to Gentiles? Or is it something else?
Just preference to the remnant.
Okay.
And some will be selected and taken. And I guess those who initially proved faithful to God were his pick, and he stuck by his promise to them.
Okay, I think, though, it's not just those who prove faithful to God. I agree with the second part of what you were saying. But, in other words, God chose Israel for a particular reason, and he stuck by them whether they were faithful to him or not. And so, again, this is sort of a central part of the argument of the chapter, you know, and the reason that Gentiles can trust God, that he's faithful to Israel, even when they're not faithful to him.
What about the scriptures that refer to God divorcing Israel,
mm-hmm.
at least for a time?
Well, that's the key part of it. You know, it's for a time. You know, for a brief moment I turned away from you, but with great love or great compassion I will gather you again. I mean, that's the point of all of those passages. And we should look probably at the scripture from Hosea that is discussed on page 125 on and quoted twice in the Messianic writings. In context, in Hosea, what is being said? God tells Hosea to call his second child no compassion. I think it's lo rachama.
Yeah.
Lo rachama in Hebrew. And the third child, lo ami. You're not not my people. What is God saying here?
Maybe that they're behaving like they're not his people.
Right. And also what you were saying with regard to some other passages, that he's going to turn away from some of Israel for a time. In the first instance, with regard to no compassion, he says, I will no longer show compassion to the house of Israel, but I will show compassion to the house of Judah. So he's saying that judgment is going to come on Israel, but he's preserving a remnant in Judah. And the third one, lo ami, you are not my people. It's again talking about judgment on Israel, but just after that, God says that the children of Israel will multiply, and in the place where it was said to them, "You are not my people," they will be called sons of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will be reunited, and they will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land.
Yep.
So in both of these passages, God is doing exactly what Vicky was describing, speaking basically of a kind of divorce for Israel's unfaithfulness, but that God will nonetheless bring them back and redeem them. So obviously in the context of Hosea, it fits with the whole theme of Hosea, which is God's love and unending faithfulness to Israel despite Israel's unfaithfulness towards God. And that's what Hosea's children are a sign of here. Does anyone have any questions on that, just how it's used in Hosea, or any alternate interpretations? No? Okay.
It's too warm in here. I think we put him to sleep.
What about with regard to the quotation in Peter? Which is what follows that in the book.
What page you on?
126.
Peter.
By the way, let me just add that in Hosea itself, the discussion concludes with God saying, "I will say to not my people, you are my people."
Yeah, which is what Peter quotes.
Right, exactly. That's what Peter quotes.
Are you talking about 1 Peter 1:1?
Yes. I mean, 1 Peter 1:1 is the beginning of that discussion because it sets the context of who he's talking about. But the quotation is in chapter 2, I think. Is it? Let's see.
Oh, 127,
is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you read that?
Yeah, I was going, why did I have to say that?
Second Peter 2:22.
It's 1 Peter chapter 2. It's before verse 11. Starting in verse 9, I think. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. And that's where the quotes are from Hosea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So does this pose any problems?
It's traditionally interpreted as the Gentiles were the ones he was referring to as not a people, and now the Gentile believers are the people of God.
Because it was just it following the passages about stumbling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that what it means, do you think?
Pardon?
Is that the correct interpretation of the passage?
He's talking to Jewish people.
Okay.
But I was just thinking it could have been interpreted that way because he, right before that, was saying how these people had rejected the cornerstone and he was a stumbling block to them. And they stumbled being disobedient to the word. But you are a chosen generation.
Okay. Who is it saying that? Who is it saying that rejected him?
Pardon? Stumbled.
Who is it saying that rejected him?
The
stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner, right? Or the rulers? I mean, the builders rejected the foundation. So again, this is the argument that's made consistently in this book that As the disciple said, the chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they put him to death on a tree. That was the witness of the disciples of Yeshua after he was crucified. That, in other words, it was the rulers of the people who decided to do this and did it. Now, in the context of Kepha's letter, Peter's letter, that seems to be what he's saying, that the rulers rejected Yeshua, but he has become the chief cornerstone, a use of a passage in Isaiah that is consistent with the meaning in Isaiah. And then he uses this passage from Hosea, if it applies to Jews, in a way that is consistent with the meaning of the passage in Hosea. So if the quotation from Hosea is designed to mean that Gentiles have been brought in, we have another problem, which is whether or not these passages are being used, being quoted by the authors of the Messianic writings in a legitimate manner. Because can he take something that's said in Hosea to mean one thing and use it in a completely different way in his writings? Well, if we keep in mind that he's writing to Jewish people, it doesn't seem that way. That's the basic argument that's presented here. Now, keep in mind that there are scriptures that talk about Gentiles being far from God and being brought in to know God.
Yeah.
But they don't this is a controversial case. Some people would say this does. But excluding this case, which appears to refer to Jews, they use different kinds of terminology to refer to Gentiles. Are there any scriptures that come to mind? Sure. Well, the scriptures do talk about Gentiles being far from God and being brought near to him. What are some of the passages that talk about that, and what language is used?
Are you talking about in the Messianic writings?
Or yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oops.
All comes to me is in the Book of Ruth, but I'm not clicking with anything in the Messianic writings.
Generally, there was a quote from Proverbs, from Isaiah 28:16. Here it on Peter, 1 Peter 2:6.
Okay.
Behold, I lay in Zion, blah blah blah. He who believes within him will by no means be put to shame. It just means that generally, anyone who believes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What about John 3:16?
Okay. All right. There are some, I can't find it this quickly, but there are some scriptures, I'm sure we're all somewhat familiar with them, that talk more specifically about Gentiles, you know, where in some of the letters it says, I'm speaking to you who are Gentiles, and he says, basically, formerly you were far from God, now you have been brought near, you've been made part of the Commonwealth of Israel, things like that. Formerly you used to behave in such and such a way, and you were slaves to idolatry, and so forth, and now you're brought near. But in those passages, there is not the appropriation of scriptures that refer specifically to God's love to Israel, in terms of bringing these Gentiles in. It's simply describing the fact that the Gentiles were far removed from God and were alienated from him. So if anyone has the chance to find a couple of those references before we finish, that would be nice. We could see the exact wording. No, just in the Messianic writings. Yeah. Did you find...
No, she was going to take her Bible and do it, and she realized it was in German. That's just payback for the little Spanish Bible, okay?
Okay, so in any event, then we have a consideration of Paul's quotation also of the same passage in Hosea. And this one says in Romans 9... Even us whom he called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. As he says in Hosea, I will call those who are not my people, my people, and I will call her who is not my loved one, my loved one. And it will happen that in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called sons of the living God.
That's
quote from Hosea again.
Right, it's the same quote.
Yeah.
Yes. So now, this one, many people also would say, well, see, he's using this to prove that Gentiles can be called also. He's saying to people who were not my people before, you are my people, and those who are not loved, now you are my loved one. And it can seem that way. Of course, in the context of Hosea, that's not what was being said, though. What was being said in Hosea was that when God temporarily spoke to Israel and called Israel not my people, he said that in to the same people and in the same place, they would be called again my people, and they would be called my loved one. So what do you make of this one? Is that an appropriate interpretation of the passage? Or is Paul really trying to use this scripture to say that people previously who were not God's people, Gentiles, have now become his people?
I would interpret that he pulled him into the family.
Okay.
It is written to the Romans, non-Jewish people.
Or a combination, maybe, of Jews and Gentiles.
And in verse 24, he talks about whom he called not from among Jews only, but also from among Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
And then he quotes this. So it seems like he's broadening the meaning of this to include Gentiles now.
Okay. Anyone else? It's Romans 9 on page 132 of the Copernicus book.
Then just after he quotes this passage from Hosea, he says, Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be like the sand of the sea, it is the remnant that will be saved.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even the same among all Jews. Because there are many from the tribes and the descendants, but only a remnant will be saved.
Uh-huh.
And those are the Jewish believers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what is the point of this passage in Romans 9? This starts to get at how my father deals with the passage. If you look at what's written before and after, he says, does not the potter have the right to make out of the same lump of clay some pottery for noble purposes and some for common use? What if God, choosing to show his wrath and make his power known, bore with great patience the objects of his wrath prepared for destruction? Who are the objects of God's wrath prepared for destruction?
Unbelievers.
Okay, are they Jews?
Some of them are.
Some of them are, but it's not. But the objects of God's wrath are not, cannot be equated to Jews, because some of them are. Are they Gentiles?
Some of them are.
Mm-hmm. But the objects of God's wrath cannot be equated to Gentiles, because many of them aren't. And he goes on, what if he did this to make the riches of his glory known to the objects of his mercy, whom he prepared in advance for glory, even us whom he called not only from Jews, but also from Gentiles? So the context of what is being described is that God has prepared some vessels for honor and some for destruction. Or he has done certain things, arrange things in this manner to make his glory known to both Jews and Gentiles. So, as always with Paul, God has his priorities, you know, not only to Jews, but also to Gentiles. As he says in Hosea, I will call them my people who are not my people, and I will call her my loved one who is not my loved one. And it will happen in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called sons of the living God. Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the Israelites be like sand by the sea, only the remnant will be saved. For the Lord will carry out his sentence on earth with speed and finality. Uh-huh. So if you read what comes before and after, it doesn't seem like he's using this verse to try to prove that Gentiles can also be saved. It doesn't seem like that's the question at all. And it doesn't seem like Paul has a problem believing that, especially if you read what he wrote previously in this letter. Uh-huh. He already knows that, right?
Yep.
That's not the question that's being discussed. That's not what he's trying to bring it as proof of. What is he trying to bring it as proof of?
That there will be remnant of Israel who will be saved.
That's right. That there's that even with regard to Israel, who was temporarily cast off by God, in that same passage in Hosea, it says God will bring them back. Those he called not my people, he will call his people. Those he called not my loved one, he will call my loved one. So that there will, and as Isaiah also says, only a remnant will be saved. So this is to, this is, these texts are being adduced to demonstrate what the actual point of his argument is, which is that the potter has the right to make out of the same lump of clay some pottery for noble purposes and some for common purposes, that some among the Israelites will be saved and some will not. And he adds in that the same principle is going to apply to Gentiles also. So I think that's a more appropriate way of understanding this. And again, it comes simply from reading a little bit more of the context and not getting caught up so much in our questions that we think are being described. In fact, I think that one thing we probably don't do often enough is read letters in their entirety, because something like the letter to the Romans or the letter to the Corinthians, they were letters. Mm-hmm. If someone wrote you a letter, would you first read, would you read a paragraph a day?
No.
Especially if it was a letter that contained crucial information about how you should live your life and a long argument was being presented. Would you read, you know, a paragraph a day, or would you put artificial breaks in the letter that weren't there and then just view it that way? Or would you pick out one sentence from the letter and say, see, such and such, this is what the letter is about? No, you'd read the whole letter. And I think oftentimes we forget that these were letters that were written as letters, meant to be read as letters, and that were in many cases addressing specific issues. So we've only read just the few verses before and after this quotation, and I think that's enough to show that the usual interpretation of it is wrong. Now, maybe people still hold to the other interpretation. We can debate it in a second if there are still people who want to debate it. But I think that's enough. But I think we would come to even a stronger conclusion and a better conclusion if we were to read the whole letter in its context and recognize the flow of the argument from chapter 1 on all the way through chapter 2 and 3 and 9 and 11 and so forth. That these are not just random sentences strung together, but there's actually something that's being discussed. And, yeah. So, does anyone want to comment on that anymore? Does anyone still hold to the traditional understanding? And I'm not saying this to try to put people on the spot or isolate them, but rather to bring out any questions that might remain about it or any objections that might still remain to the interpretation that's proposed in this chapter, so that we could discuss them if there are any other good challenges to that view. Because, by the way, outside of this room, you will find only a handful of people who agree with what I just said.
I'm totally confused.
Okay, let's go more slowly then. Yeah.
You know what Kyra was saying at first, and so what are Gentile believe? Are they part of the people of God, or I mean, are they just they're grafted in? Yeah, but so are Gentile believers people of God?
Right.
I'm going to think I need to go back and say, okay, this goes to the Jews, this goes to the Gentiles. I mean, what are my instructions?
Right. Well, I think a distinction has to be made between in sort of what you mean by the people of God. Mm-hmm. If you mean the people of God in the way that God identifies him throughout the scriptures as distinct from other peoples, many of whom had their own gods, but that's not necessary in this case for it to be true.
Okay.
Then the people of God are Israel. Now, if you mean that someone has become attached to the people of God and joined the Commonwealth of Israel and entered into that relationship with him, then I think there are Gentiles who are included in that. But it's in a specific way that it's described. Well, I mean, again, I think this is also in later chapters, you know, as being part of the Commonwealth of Israel, for example. It's not, in other words, it's not through becoming Jews. It's not through becoming the same as the people that God has identified with throughout history. It's attaching oneself to that people. So earlier you were asking about Ruth, for instance. Well, the scriptures do not say that Ruth became Jewish. Actually, what they do say is that she became a mother, you know, a great-grandmother of the Messianic line. But they do not say that she became Jewish, and in fact, they continue to refer to her as the Moabitess.
Yeah.
So she didn't lose her identity as a Moabitess. Mm-hmm. And Gentiles don't lose their identity as Gentiles. We didn't read what is maybe the linchpin of the whole argument there in Romans 1 and 2, where it says that the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. In other words, God has created Jews and Gentiles for certain purposes. He doesn't revoke that. God has created men and women for certain purposes. He doesn't revoke that. So there is a connection that is established between Jews and Gentiles who believe in the Messiah, which breaks down barriers completely, which is supposed to be regarded as an incredible thing because we're supposed to understand that Jews and Gentiles are very different. And so the fact that they can come together in that way is sort of a miracle. But it's similar to men and women. You know, there's a union between a man and a woman in marriage that is something that God created for his purposes. But men and women maintain their identity in that marriage. So I think that's basically, you know, the best way that I could explain it. I don't know if that's what you were asking.
Something that just sort of struck me, and I can't certainly refer to any Bible text before, but it seems as though with so much authority laid upon Jewish people, the Gentiles could well be very helpful to them.
And, yes. You know, it's absolutely. I think so. And I mean, I think this is one of the main reasons why Israel is so troubled, obviously, in the world, because Gentiles are not fulfilling their responsibility towards Jews. Now, the responsibilities are many. If you look at what Paul says in another passage, he writes about Gentile believers who are very poor, but nonetheless gave money to help the holy ones in Jerusalem, the Jewish believers, because they recognized that they had received all of these spiritual things from the Jews,
mm-hmm.
the scriptures,
yeah.
the Messiah, mm-hmm. knowledge of the one true God, and that they owed them yeah. a great debt, and that to assist financially was only a small way to help repay this great debt that Gentile believers owe the Jews. So that's definitely true. But in addition to that, I would say that, you know, we've said it here today, but it's said all throughout Tanakh. Did God intend for Gentiles to be separate from him and to disobey him?
No.
No. In fact, God created Gentiles before he created Jews. God created the nations before there was a nation of Israel, and he expected them to be faithful to him,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some individuals were, and we read about these individual Gentiles all throughout Tanakh that knew God, you know, in places far removed from Israel, right? So God never stopped expecting Gentiles to serve him, but that didn't make them any less Gentile. They were still perfectly Gentile, but he expected them, as we see in Romans as well, he expected Gentiles as well as Jews to serve him and to love him and to know him. And it just so happened that the nations, by and large, decided not to serve God. And God's way of dealing with that was to create a new nation, a special people that on whom he would place his name and who would be his representatives to the nation. So that's what's meant in a couple places in this chapter where it says the chosenness of Israel does not depend upon Israel's merit or worthiness to be chosen. And God says this explicitly, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you are more numerous than other peoples, for you are the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your fathers that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So it was God who decided to do things this way. And the chosenness of Israel is demanded by the failure of the Gentiles. In other words, the very purpose for which God created the Gentiles was, I'm sorry, created the Jews, was because of the situation with the Gentiles, that the Gentiles were expected to be serving God, but they weren't. Mm. Now, Israel didn't necessarily do any better, but that's irrelevant to God's choice. God chose to do things this way. He chose to place a specific calling on the Jewish people, which is different than the calling on the nations. And he says that his choice is irrevocable because he has no partiality. And he's going to judge Jews and Gentiles differently according to how he has made them, because he doesn't have any partiality. So these are things that he says in the Messianic writings, you know, in what Christians call the New Testament. It's not the typical Christian sermon, of course, but consider it, because these are texts that would be used to give sermons with quite a different slant. Yeah.
So, I guess I was going to say what you just said, that scripture was taken out of context in itself, saying that God was giving them a different punishment. Is that?
Well, it says there's punishment first to Jews and then to nations, Goyim.
Interpretations. Are you saying that particular grouping of scriptures was taken? Of asking you to think for other people there by asking that particular way. But were you specifically pulling those scriptures out and saying that those particular ones were part of misinterpretation in terms of how Jewish people should be treated by people?
Well, I think that those particular scriptures are more overlooked than misinterpreted, because it's hard to make them fit into typical patterns, I guess, or people would interpret them as being chronological. In other words, first God dealt with the Jews and gave them punishments and rewards, and now he's dealing with the Gentiles. I don't think that's what's being said there, and I don't think that's what's being said in Romans 1:16 when it talks about the good news being to the Jew first and also to the Gentiles. And I don't think that's the reason that Paul went first to the synagogue in each place he went. I think it's a principle that God has put in, that Yeshua was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and even his apostle, his emissary, his messenger, the one that he sent out to the Gentiles, went first to the Jews. Because that's just the way that God has chosen it, so as not to have partiality. That's the way he explains it. And the big issue is really the question of whether or not God is consistent. Most theology and interpretation of the Bible takes the view that God is not consistent, that God changes his mind a lot. And he did one thing at one time, and then he sort of changed the rules at another point in time. I don't think that's a good way of looking at God. And I think that even in the passages that seem strange to us, like God seeming to have a slightly different way, standard or different way of treating Jews and Gentiles, it's not a different standard, but a different order, a different way of treating them, a discrimination in our terminology. Even in those examples, it shows his consistency. I think that's part of the whole point of it, how he expected certain things from Gentiles in Genesis, and here in Romans, he says exactly the same thing. Even if they don't have the law, they're still responsible to God. Mm-hmm. He expected certain things from Israel in Exodus. And here in Romans, he's saying the same thing. If they have the law, they're responsible for that knowledge that they have that God has revealed to them. And because God is fair and wants to treat people fairly, he's going to judge people who have law as if they have law, and people who don't have law as if they don't have law. Yeah.
I think there's a missing word in English.
Mm-hmm.
I can say that you're a Jew.
Right.
But I can't really say I'm a Gentile. I'm not a nation.
Right.
I can say I'm Scottish.
Mm-hmm.
But there seems to be a word that's missing for an individual person. Non-Jew, but yeah, that's just kind of...
Right.
It just seems to be missing.
Right. Well, part of the solution might be to view yourself as part of a nation. Now, in the United States, a lot of different nations have merged together to create an almost nationless nation. In other parts of the world, people have a much stronger national identity. And if you're French, you're French. And if you're German, you're German. You know, and you know which nation you're a part of. And you understand that it's one of the nations of the earth. Americans don't have as strong a sense of nationhood. But... in that respect, Americans are probably more removed from the world of the Bible, I would say. So, I mean, you could, for example, view yourself as an American among the nations.
Identity, yeah. That would not be my ethnic identity.
Right. That's true. But that's also because of the merging of people groups in the United States. But in terms of, you know, Jew or non-Jew, you were saying, mm-hmm. Well, America is, in a sense, one of the nations, mm-hmm. even if it has represented, you know, a merging of many different kinds of nations. So it's not as clear cut an example as, let's say, the Midianites, who are both mm-hmm. an ethnicity and a nation. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, some peoples today who have preserved a stronger sense of nationality. But it's a closer approximation than just saying I'm nothing.
And everybody is somebody.
Right. Right. And again, the point is not that Jews... Yeah. The point is not that Jews are better, because the Bible clearly shows that they aren't. The point is that God has decided to do certain things, and he didn't change his mind. And in fact, he said he wasn't going to change his mind. Now, let me come back to Barry. I don't know if that clarified anything or made it more confusing, but...
Jews are the only ones that have a national identity with God. Like, Gentiles can't say, my nation belongs to God. Right. Jews can say, my nation, or, yeah. you know, yeah. our people belong to God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Course. I mean, I think that there is a kind of paradox in that God is not the God of the Jews only. He's also the God of the Goyim. He created the Goyim as well as the Jews. You know, Jonah, when he was sent out to some of the Goyim, he said, you know, I'm a Hebrew, and I serve the God who created the heavens and the earth. And they understood what that meant. Those Hebrews worship the one God. The God over all the heavens and all the earth. And Shaul said the same thing to the Athenians, who worship many gods. He said, you know, I observed your temple, your altar to an unknown God. Now let me proclaim him to you. He's not made by human hands. He made everything that is. So there's a sense in which, of course, all peoples belong to God and the heavens and the earth belong to God. But I think that there's also a definite sense in which God identifies himself as having a special relationship with Israel. And it's not just for his own sake that he does this. He expects Gentiles to acknowledge this, apparently. Right. He expects Gentiles to acknowledge that he has a special relationship with Israel.
A person becomes a believer and receives all the blessings through the Messiah, they identify with people of God, the nation that God identifies with, or, you know. So Gentile believers are people of God, but they're not...
they're part of the family, but not Jewish.
There's no conversion to being Jewish when they become believers.
Yeah, they're not...
They're not converted.
They don't
right.
become descendants of... Isaac.
Right. Correct.
Right. And the point of the chapter is that when God speaks about his people, who is the people of God? God's own people. He's talking about Jews.
Right.
He's talking about Israel. So In some cases, that may have implications also for Gentiles who have attached themselves to Jewish people. But if one interprets it, his people, as being something different, which it often is, you know, being the Christian church, it will lead into very serious error.
I think it's also important to remember that just as God has different jobs for men and women, he has different jobs ready for Jews and Gentiles. If everybody was male, everybody was female, everybody was Jew, everyone was Gentile, what he purposed us to do would not work as it was supposed to. So we have to have Jews and Gentiles. We have to have male and female. These things are important. That's how he created us. Yet we were all created in the image of God, and all of us had the right, the same right, the same direction to salvation through Yeshua. So one is not better than the other. We just have different obligations and responsibilities under where we were placed as either Jew or Gentile or male or female. And it is time that we stop. So I want you to remember, please, that next week is chapter 10. And that is a little case of mistaken identity. There are no Christians in the Bible. We're going to talk about the multitudes and who the multitudes were and where they went following him. But you are welcome to stay around for a bit and partake of some snacks and some fellowship. We don't want to rush anybody out who has a need. Okay?